Good evening. It's 6 o'clock. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, the show about theater on the radio, from drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between. Professional, student, and community productions in and around Montreal, Chautauqua, where we spell theater with an R-E at the end. I'm your host, Sarah De A, recording from home on Thursday, December 30th, 2021, our final show of the year. On tonight, a look back at some of my favorite interviews from another pandemic theater year. My guests, Ange Loft, the first Indigenous artist in residence at Centaur Theater.
I was trying to explain what my next career thing would be, and I said, you know what, I want to be an archaeology artist. And I was like, what is that exactly? I'm just making up a job for myself, which more or less means that by the time I'm 50, I would love to be able to walk into an archive in any place within Ganyakahaga territory and be comfortable.
Jamie Blay, newly appointed artistic director at Geordie Theatre.
It was scary and it was a hard decision, but I had to take it because I felt like I couldn't continue doing what I was doing for the rest of my life. I was kind of lying to myself, you know, so I kind of closed my eyes and jumped, and I'm really happy I did.
And Leanne Taylor, an actress who performed from home in a live telephone play for an audience of one.
And I have to admit that even though I really don't know who the audience members are that I've shared this experience with, I feel so connected to each and every one of them.
As you no doubt know, cultural venues are closed in Quebec as the province deals with another surge in COVID cases. I myself came down with COVID earlier this month. It felt like a mild cold and it was rough for a few days, but I'm doing much better and my most recent rapid test came back negative. It was so good to finally go outside again. So while we wait for things to improve and we stay safe, we can hopefully look forward to new theater experiences in 2022. And in the meantime, we can look back on the movers and shakers of this scene from the past year. In fall 2020, Centaur Theatre in Old Montreal launched a discussion to decide how to better attract diverse candidates to the space. The theatre applied for new granting from the Conseil des Arts de Montréal to prioritize Indigenous voices. And so at the start of the year, the Centaur put out an appeal for a new position, the theatre's first Indigenous artist residency. Artistic and executive director Ida Holmes acknowledged that, quote, Indigenous stories are a key part of Chautauqua and Montreal's heritage, and yet their stories have been missing throughout Centaur's half-century history. A few months later, the chosen candidate was revealed, Ange Loft, an interdisciplinary performance artist and initiator from nearby Ganawage who got her start in that community's community theater as a youngster, and she's since worked in Toronto and elsewhere in Canada. Ange has been directing Indigenous-oriented theater projects for over two decades, with a special focus on history. Notably, she teaches story creation for the Centre for Indigenous Theatre in Toronto, the only post-secondary conservatory of its kind in the country. One of the criteria for the candidates for this position at Centaur was someone plugged into the local Indigenous artistic community, and Ange fits the bill. Her ambitions are not just to create art, but to dig deep into the Centaur's footprint in Old Montreal. Steps from where a bedrock colonial accord was signed with various First Nations. When I spoke with her last summer, I met someone who was not just thinking of the stage, but looking to explore the past, literally and figuratively, through archives and records to visiting into the dark basement of the Centaur. She has done research in her hometown of Ganawage, at the Smithsonian National Museum of the American Indian, and the Royal Ontario Museum. As she puts it, quote, by exposing the complex relationship between Indigenous nations and colonial powers, we remind Quebec and Canada of past agreements made in trust, expose the upheaval caused by imposed ideologies and social practices, and most importantly, celebrate the resilience, resistance, and resurgence of Indigenous thought, end quote. Ange brings with her the Talking Treaties Chautauqua Collective, a trio of three Ganyakahaga women with ties to Ganawage. She forms it with Barbara Gonera, Denis Daibo, and Yahande Foote. I'm very eager to see what this trio produces. Their year-long work began late last summer, and I spoke with Ange while she took a break from her work seated at the Centaur Theatre. Here is our conversation. What was your reaction when you found out that you were getting this position?
Well, it came at a time period where I was actually trying to pull some beans together and make my way back to Ganawage in Montreal anyway. I had a bit of a family loss and I was thinking, you know what, I need to make a project that would bring me closer to home. That'll give me excuses to return back to my family's home and be around town a little bit more. So yeah, kind of an excitement that I'd get to come home and work in Montreal with such a good amount of support. Yeah.
Well, I'm really sorry to hear about your loss for your family and for you. When you say being out of Ganawage, Montreal area, you were in Toronto, right? You've been working at the Center for Indigenous Theatre, is that correct?
Yeah, I work at the Center for Indigenous Theatre. I started there only a year ago, actually, teaching story creation, but I've been in Toronto for about since 2008. So I work with a company there called Jumbly's Theatre, and we do predominantly community arts. So I've been kicking around for a few years, I guess, in the community arts world as associate artistic director there.
And tell me about, I'm curious about the center. This is a unique place in regards to how the work is done, right? In terms of training and the art that comes out of it.
The Center for Indigenous Theatre is pretty rad. You know, we try to hire quite a few Indigenous instructors, and I'm actually having the opportunity coming up to work with, get all of the students and bring them to a nice place on the Credit River and make a whole new production there that's actually about the dish with one spoon. So it's been really good to kind of have their trust and really, you know, get to know the students that way.
Oh, I do want to talk about dish with one spoon in a moment, but I'm also curious about how you as a student came up and how you got your start in theater. Did you first kind of cross the boards at Turtle Island Theater Company in Ganawage?
Sure did. Yeah, Turtle Island Theater Company was, I guess, my stomping ground. There's a really wonderful man who was there named Kevin Saylor, and he brought a, you know, really inspired a lot of this starting up over there. We spent a lot of our formative years doing musicals and making props from whatever was donated and this kind of scrappy-do way of making, but it's carried forward, you know. But from there, I took a little while. I thought I was going to be an anthropologist or an archaeologist or a sociologist and ended up diving right back into theater. I went to Concordia, did my major at Concordia, and then realized at that point I didn't know how to make my own work, right? Still, you know, so I had to go to Center for Indigenous Theater and do some mentorship under some of their professors. So took off, ran away to Toronto, and, you know, got a chance to train under some really great people there.
That's so interesting that you had thought that your path might be as a scientist of some sort. Do you still consider like anything that you might have picked up in anthropology or in sociology is being part of how you interrogate or teach or learn?
Oh, I was trying to explain what my next career thing would be. And I said, you know what? I want to be an archaeology artist. And I was like, what is that exactly? I'm just making up a job for myself, which more or less means that by the time I'm 50, I would love to be able to walk into an archive in any place within Ganyakahaga territory and be comfortable and know how to operate their systems and how to get in and out of all of their cherry pickers and look in the drawers. That's my favorite kind of thing to do, is actually spending some time inside some, like, you know, archives, places that get to dig around. And yeah, I love those kind of connections. Some of my favorite things involve things that are buried under the ground. So.
Definitely. Putting it out there, is there anything that you might be able to share as being a favorite thing that you've discovered in a drawer or under the ground at this point in your career?
Well, there's a really large story. I'm still really, really interested in these things called bird stones. Mm-hmm. So that's another level. But yeah, I had the chance one time, quite a few years ago, talking about the dish with one spoon, to go speak with some people at the ROM. I just booked an appointment, and I was so intrigued by this idea of, you know, just some shelves hidden away that have a whole bunch of little pieces of flint and pottery fragments and, you know, the things that aren't really put together enough to put out to display, but tell a really serious story. But yeah, that's been my subtle obsession for the past couple years in Toronto, is trying to piece together this sort of underground narrative for the settlement patterns and different processes that would have seen lots of populations come and go over over a landscape.
So you just said the ROM, that's the Royal Ontario Museum, I believe. So getting there, you kind of got a chance to kind of go behind the scenes and to discover these stones. And that's something that's kind of something you're hoping to discover in other places as well.
Yeah. As part of this work, I'm trying to connect up with quite a few people. You know, there's a lot of hidden history and a lot of people in Montreal that you just have to find the right people to speak to, really. You know, today we were talking. I had an interview today. I asked on purpose to talk to Chuck here, the general manager at the Centaur, just get his take on the building and his relationship to, he has a ton of information. So I like to do that. Find one of the people, some of the most senior people in the room and ask them questions, you know? So that's one of my processes. So I'm hoping to connect up with Pointe au Calier, connect up with a couple different organizations, and maybe even make my way into that secret Sulpician garden that's right behind the Centaur.
Oh, a secret garden behind that's interesting. I didn't know that.
Oh yeah. Yeah, it's a completely hidden garden. So we have a lot of interesting kind of connections between this area of the old Montreal and my own community. So I'm drawing some of those lines and trying to figure out some of those stories that we have, I guess, in our oral history, that kind of make the connections financially, actually, to the creation of the large church that's next to us.
Oh, and this Notre Dame Basilica.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, so there's a lot of oral history around that place.
Yeah, I'm speaking with Ange Loft. She is the first ever Indigenous artist in residence at Centaur Theatre, embarking on her year-long residency this month. I know that they were searching high and low for submissions for this particular position. And so did you talk about the history and what you were hoping to do? What I'm almost imagining is almost like an archaeological dig, metaphorically speaking, of the space and all the history in old Montreal. Was that like really what you pushed forward when you were making your out year application?
Well, I was trying to think of this ask that they put out there. You know, let's talk about some of the hidden histories, some of the things that aren't brought up too often when we talk about Indigenous presence in the city. And I had previously just done a residency with Studio 303, exploring kind of like a lot of these things with a whole new team of artists and some guests. And that was actually where I brought in my collaborator, Barbara. Mm-hmm. So it was just we applied and started thinking about a few things that were already on my plate. You know, I've been researching for years this agreement about the dish with one spoon that kind of brings us to this area around the 1701 time period. Definitely a conversation that involves the Anishinaabe. There's definitely a conversation that involves a lot of the nations that span across this between more or less right here all the way to Sault Ste. Marie. So long, huge, huge agreement that would have been essentially forged in and around this area. So I pitched a little bit of a deep dive into the Great Peace of Montreal, which is a kind of really large endeavor that the French put together to help bring some, it's a very complicated story, but let's say a lot of Indigenous nations decided to put their fighting down and come to some understanding. So that was one of the stories that I was intrigued by because it's so connected to Montreal, to Cho-Chiage. And another one that I was really interested in was a belt, actually a wampum belt, that's called the Two Dog Wampum Belt. And it's related to the people of Gunasadage. And it's regarding, I guess, essentially their exodus from the island that was in relationship to the religious folks that would have been around that area at the time. So they'd been expelled from the island and made to go live around the Lake of Two Mountains area. And so it was about 1721, but there's a wampum belt that goes along with it that is super intriguing to me. So that was one of the main visuals I had. I love working in this kind of large scale way. So I really think like image first, And so mm-hmm. that was one of the images that really popped up, just this visual of moving this belt across the stage and across in and around some places. So that's what that was the main pitch, more or less. But the addition to that was thinking about some of those questions around unceded territory. How do we get to that conversation? And then who should I talk to in Gunawage that could help me inform, get some information out of them. So I've started that process now, the who should we talk to? Who are the people that have this information, right?
And it's not just history in the last 50 years, we're stretching back hundreds of years.
Yeah.
Makes it kind of tricky, I imagine.
I mean, I have a personal preference for this time period between, say, the 1650s and the early 1700s. I just have a really, really, really deep interest in the the earliest records of what could have been in and around this area. I've spent a lot of time with, like, the Jesuit archives and just kind of trying to piece together what life and, you know, making these agreements would have looked like for, yeah, this area quite a long time ago. Things really shift politically after. So yeah. I don't like the gnarly period of Indigenous history. I kind of like the period where there's still some negotiations, some, right. you know, some conversations based on Indigenous protocols and practices. You know, I like kind of imagining a different world from that perspective.
I'm speaking with Ange Loft, who is the first Indigenous artist in residence at Santora Theatre, and we're talking about some of the work that she's already started as her residency begins this month. Ange, you've been referencing Dish with One Spoon. It's this kind of this concept about sharing that has really deep roots. Can you explain to me some of that and how it pertains to your work?
Well, it's kind of funny thinking about making, you know, even thinking about making costumes and things with donations. I could draw back to the Dish with One Spoon, thinking about my own approaches to
your early days.
Yeah, not wanting to overconsume the different kind of personal choices you make that have to refer to some of the tenets, I guess, of this agreement, right? So it's an agreement that's Indigenous nation-to-nation agreement that kind of, there's a lot of origin stories for where it comes from, but one of them is connected to the great law, the Kayanarakoa, the creation of that, in a moment where they had all 50 chiefs sitting in a circle and the peacemaker went and passed around a big dish of beaver tail stew and people were told to essentially take what you need and make sure that that dish makes it around the whole circle. So conceptually embodied kind of learning practice to really kind of nail it home that we all have to share what is in the environment. We have to share, be respectful, keep it clean, make sure there's enough for the future, make sure that there's that we all get what we need to sustain our livelihoods and our lives, but at the same time be super cognizant of our capacity to overconsume. So I've been thinking a lot about that agreement and, you know, it doesn't necessarily involve a lot of non-Indigenous people, but we talk about it sometimes, particularly in Toronto these days. They mention we're on Dish with One Spoon territory, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know how much they do that in Montreal, but very often we talk about it like it's this beautiful, simple sharing agreement. But yeah, the dance project I'm working on currently, a lot, you know, parallel. I have multiple projects running right now. I had a rehearsal this morning for a project I have called Dish Dances that I'm doing in Toronto, actually in Brampton. But yeah, it's like talking about the kind of dark aspects of it, the capacity we have for we've laid down some rules, but essentially, people are always going to break them. So we have to make sure we keep coming back to council and negotiating these things between ourselves. I'm talking about nation to nation, Indigenous nations, right? Mm-hmm. So it's a pretty long story and it's a really big concept, but it actually has its heart in Xochitl, in and around this area and with the Haudenosaunee people. And yeah, it was extended way out. Keep having it pop up in conversation over and over again as we move along. Move along history timeline. Yeah.
One of the things that Ida Holmes, the artistic director and executive director at Centaur, mentioned in your selection was that you have curiosity, imagination, and passion. I'm hearing so much of that just listening to you talk about your some of your work and the paths that you hope to go down. And I'm super interested to see how things are going to, what's going to come out of this residency. So I guess maybe just you've got a lot of research ahead of you. I know that that's a really big part of your work. What can we expect as audience members? Do you think this is going to come out as a theatrical piece at some point this season or next season? What are your hopes for what audiences will see?
Well, we're looking at this year, taking our time with myself, Yohande, and Barbara. Just taking our time this year to do our research, to pull together essentially a draft for next summer, for August. We're finishing our residency in August next year. So by that point, I'm hoping to have a nice draft of what we're imagining. Barbara is a movement artist. So she's going to spend some time in here in December in our next kind of big push all together that we get a chance to work in. And Barbara's going to get a chance to do some physical explorations of some of our ideas. And then I work in really, as I mentioned, really large scale imagery, kind of in this world of puppetry. I tend to work, I guess, you know, community centered work. So it's going to be a fine line, you know, trying to balance the stories that we bring out, the stories that I think are the most pertinent and the stories that I would really like to kind of put back on the table here. Right. So there's a lot of but also, I mean, my own interest just in the things that are underground in this area, in the Old Port area. I love this idea that a lot of the places where cities, you know, where the downtown cores of cities tended to be built right on top of archaeological, you know, old villages and previous sites, you know, a lot of the times the people that would come to settle upon Indigenous territory just chose the places that were the most convenient to plop down their towns. So what was here in this area before, you know, there's really exciting things. We took a tour yesterday of the Centaur and got a chance to go in the basement and into the pit and into some really exciting places and spaces around this area. And I started thinking about tunnels and digging and connections to the Sulpicians and connections to Ganawage and to the various buildings and structures that are intimately connected to our own families, you know, our own communities. The people in our communities built a lot of the architecture that we identify with as Montreal things, mm-hmm. you know, thinking about the cross on Mount Royal. There's so many places I like to say, you know, my father says like, yeah, my grandfather built that, you know? So we have that kind of coming up quite a bit.
It sounds like it's also personal, right?
It's very personal. When we talk about the large church next to us, there's, you know, it connects up to some of the current issues we have in Ganawage. Yes. We have connections to land claim issues that some people say that whole basilica was built upon some of the rents that would have come from people renting out, from the Jesuits or Sulpicians renting out portions of our land to farmers, you know? So there's old people that say, hey, that basilica is ours, actually. That was supposed to be, you know, the money had been siphoned into creating that big church. So it's just like, it's very personal when you get down to it and ownership of buildings, where people feel like they actually belong and where they see their own labor building up a place.
That was Ange Loft, the Centaur Theater's first ever Indigenous artist in residence. She began her work this summer with two other artists, Barbara Gonera Denis Daivo and Yohande Foot, together known as the Talking Treaties Chochage Collective. You can find out more about their work at centaurtheater.com. I'm Sarah De A, and you're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, coming to you from my home yet again this week. Tonight, we are revisiting the past year in theater in Montreal. Still to come, an actress explains how she puts on a show for just one audience member without ever even leaving her home.
Are you age 60 and over? Now's the time to make your appointment for your booster dose against COVID-19. Visit quebec.ca/COVID vaccine to book your appointment online. To continue protecting yourself against COVID-19 and its variants, get a booster dose and keep following distancing measures, wearing a mask, and washing your hands. The booster dose, the best way to stay protected longer. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
2022 was a big year for actor and director Jimmy Blais. He took over the reins at Geordie, Montreal's theatrical home for kids and families. He succeeded Mike Payette, a Montrealer who left the position to run the prestigious Tarragon Theatre in Toronto. Jimmy, like Mike, is a Montrealer, born and raised, and he is a member of the Muskeg Lake Cree Nation in Treaty 6 territory. In addition to continuing the good work at Geordie, Jimmy wants to work on outreach to both Indigenous communities and beyond. Jimmy's career includes many stops: Stratford, Centaur Theatre, Imigo, Porte-Parole, and the National Arts Centre, as well as the recently launched Indigenous Artists in Residence program at NTS. But his big break came from Geordie itself. As Jimmy will explain to you in a moment, a few years back he had taken a break from acting. He was working a good job in a totally different field, when one phone call changed everything. I spoke with Jimmy Blais earlier, back in September, about that moment and his vision for Geordie as the company enters its fifth decade. Congratulations on your new role.
Thanks for having me, Sarah, and thank you very much.
Geordie is not only a theater company that focuses on producing stories for kids and for families, and it's a lot of fun, but it's also a place where a lot of really young performers cut their teeth. It's often a first professional gig for a lot of people coming out of theater school, including yourself. And you were just telling me an interesting story about how you had almost finished your degree in theater. You walked away, but Geordie brought you back to the stage. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was studying at Concordia in the theater performance program, and I had one credit left, I think, to graduate. But I needed money so bad that I had to stop, and I needed to start working full time. And so what happened was, as I had a friend who was working in Ville Saint-Laurent, like the industrial areas of Côte de Liesse, for a company that was a point of sale hardware distributor. So I picked up this job as a sales coordinator, a very entry level job. I stayed there for a while, and then there was a position in marketing. So I applied for that, and then I got promoted within the company, and I stayed there for a while. I stayed there for over 2 years, and I essentially became like a businessman right out of theater school. And I was traveling and, you know, having business meetings and wining and dining people. And I was severely unhappy. I missed being creative, and I missed the arts. And I don't know if the universe was listening, but one day I got a call at my desk at this marketing job. And it was a fellow actor of mine, somebody who I went to school with, named Antoine. And he said, hey, I'm doing the Geordie tour this year. And the two directors of the two shows that Geordie's putting up, Amanda Kellogg and Dean Fleming, are interested in seeing you for an audition for the tour. Do you want to like come in? I can set it up for you. And it didn't take me long. I almost immediately said yes. And so I guess maybe a week later, I went in and auditioned, and they gave me the part on the spot. So I had, I guess, a tough decision to make, but I took it, and I quit my job, and I went on tour for 8 months. And it was kind of the beginning of my professional career as an actor.
It must have taken a big leap of faith to walk away from this professional job where you're pulling in a salary and to get back into the arts.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's the whole trope of a struggling actor. And, you know, that's actually very real. I've known a lot of people that, you know, I've had a really tough time trying to make it as a professional actor, even before I decided to do that. And so it was scary, and it was a hard decision, but I had to take it because I felt like I couldn't continue doing what I was doing for the rest of my life. I was kind of lying to myself, you know, so I kind of closed my eyes and jumped, and I'm really happy I did.
So Jordy was at the heart of your return to a life in the arts, and now here you are heading it up. What's your thoughts embarking on this new chapter?
I'm really excited. Jordy has been a part of my career since the get. I've done so many things with them and for them, and they're in a really good place right now. I think, you know, the company has seen a lot of growth over the last 10, 15 years, and I'm really excited to take the company into the next kind of foray, to the next part of their growth. You know, and learn and be able to jump into really exciting theater at a really exciting time. I think right now it's a really interesting time to speak to kids. There's a lot going on in the world. And so doing what we do, spark conversation, I think we have a lot to talk about, and we have a lot of material to pull from. So I'm actually just really excited to get started.
I'm speaking with Jimmy Blay, who begins as artistic director at Jordy Theatre this fall, and we're talking about his transition, his return to the company. You mentioned all the interesting things that we can talk about with kids right now. There's a lot going on in the world. One of the things that you're interested in, especially, is Indigenous storytelling. That's part of your background and your story. And you feel that there is definitely room for improvement in the amount of representation on stages. Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah, I think in reality, my concern is actually in Indigenous voice. Mm-hmm. I think we're starting to see a growth in Indigenous actors and representation on stage, but what it boils down to is telling Indigenous stories from Indigenous writers, and seeing the shows being put together by Indigenous directors, and you know, supported by Indigenous designers, and so. That's one of the things that I really love to focus on while I'm here is, you know, taking some of these stories that, you know, might be Indigenous at the roots or at the core, or, you know, about an Indigenous person or character, but stories that are also, you know, entertaining, and stories that are very relatable across the board, culturally speaking, and bring them to young people and allow you know, Jordy audiences to be able to see potentially a different way of seeing things and a different way of thinking. And, you know, one of the things I'm also very interested in is taking these stories, Indigenous or non-Indigenous, back up to some of the Northern Indigenous communities of Quebec, the ones that Jordy used to visit back in the mid 90s. I'd love to be able to rekindle relationships and start having real conversations with these communities, and potentially using Indigenous story.
You had actually worked on the Indigenous Artist in Residence program at the the National Theater School here. You developed a play there. I was wondering how much of a role that program, how did it help and shape your artistry?
Well, that was kind of the first step I took into branching off from acting into more of a creative role in terms of storytelling. So I really did focus on playwriting and directing. And because this was in the back of my mind, the idea that I would be, you know, potentially growing from just an actor into somebody who's more of an all-round theater practitioner and artist, this was the first step to do that. And so the residency really provided a wonderful opportunity for me to be able to explore that creative voice in a very liberating way. They were very supportive. And the play I wrote while I was there, was the first play I ever wrote. And so, I'll always have super fond memories of my experience there. And I could definitely say that helped kickstart this new phase in my career.
Jimmy, you're also a dad. You've got a 4-year-old at home. I was wondering, I think anybody could take on the role of being AD of Jordy and not necessarily be a parent, but I'm sure that's imbued a different appreciation for what the company does, this experience for you. Can you tell me about what being a parent over the last couple of years has meant for your understanding of how kids take in theater?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's opened my eyes to how kids function and how their brains work. Not to say that I understand it at all. I don't think I understand or I'm not a kid specialist in any way, but I do have experience living with one. And I think like just being able to observe her, her name is Indigo, being able to observe Indigo on a day-to-day basis is just giving me so much information and fuel to be able to support the work that we do here. It constantly lives in my mind of how, you know, she would take something or how she would think of something and, you know, how transcribable that is to our rehearsal process and to the potential performances we create and, you know, what she enjoys at home, what sparks her interest, what keeps her engaged, all that kind of stuff is definitely food for I think what would end up being a stronger story.
I'm speaking with Jimmy Blay, who is entering the position of artistic director at Geordie Theatre. You've highlighted the fact that Geordie was, number one, the place where you kind of came to really be a professional actor, but you've also worked behind the scenes in the administration, as well as directing with the company. You're directing a show right now. But I'm also wondering what experiences outside of Geordie have shaped you as an artist. We talked a little bit about taking part in the Indigenous Artist in Residence program at NTS, but you've had a broad experiences in a lot of different places.
Yeah. I mean, you know, where do I start? I think, you know, if I was to think back, what I like to do a lot of the times is try to work my way backwards and see like what led me to where I am right now. And, you know, if we go all the way back, I would say it's Geordie, but one big step in my career or one big project that I took on that, you know, wasn't necessarily the biggest in grandeur and I wasn't front and center or, you know, the lights weren't on me, but it was actually played a really important part in where I am today was being the assistant director of Pig Girl for Micheline Chevrier's production with Imago Theatre. Mm-hmm. Because from that, I think that, you know, that was probably the first... that was the first time that I was forced to face a really complex and complicated and hard story involving Indigenous folks. And I was also able to meet Renata Arluck, who I later acted under at the Stratford Festival in the Breathing Hole. And so, you know, I go back and I link the Pig Girl experience to my time at Stratford and then my time, you know, at Banff, at the Banff Center, where she's the executive director and artistic director of Indigenous arts there.
Right.
I was there for an amazing process and 2-week workshop a couple of years ago of a play that she wrote called Powagan, which is a beautiful Indigenous adaptation or retelling of Macbeth. And so, you know, I think that was actually really a fundamental show for me, even though I don't think I got paid for it. And I definitely was, you know, sacrificing a little bit for that and professionally speaking, but yeah, I'd have to pinpoint that as one big one for me for sure.
Oh, Pig Girl was such a searing challenging play to take in as an audience member, I'll just say. And speaking of working with artistic greats, the interesting thing is that the outgoing director, Mike Payette, who's headed off to Tarragon Theatre, he joined Upstage a couple of months back to talk about leaving and trying something new, but he's actually going to be working in tandem with you in this transition period. So Mike is still going to be working closely with you. It's remarkable to mention that you are the fourth artistic director in Geordie's 40-year history. you're taking on a lot of history here.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and I'm lucky enough to have pretty good relationships with Mike and Dean, the two previous artistic directors, and you know, and I know Elsa. I've had conversations with her, so I feel connected to the artistic leadership already, and you know, Mike has planned a fantastic transition. For you know the person to step in, which ended up being me, a nice long transition, which helps. It helps everybody involved. It helps the people, you know, who are currently working for Geordie. It helps myself, and I think, you know, it was really well planned. Mike and I go way back, actually. Mike and I, the first play I've ever acted in wasn't necessarily a professional play. The first play I ever acted in was a play called Progression, which was a table d'hote play back in 2005. And Mike was the artistic director along with Mathieu Perron back then. And Mike was in it. Mike and I acted together on stage. And so he and I go way, way back. So, this is an interesting kind of full circle moment in terms of our relationship. And I'm just really happy to be a part of it with him.
That was Jimmy Blay, the newly appointed artistic director at Geordie Theatre. He is the fourth person in the role, following founder Elsa Bolam, Dean Patrick Fleming, and Meg Payette. Now, as theatres are currently closed and it's not clear what will happen in January, it's hard to predict what theatres will be up to, but I can tell you Geordie's plans as they stand. The theatre's season is expected to continue in the new year with Other Worlds, set on a small island that is being overdeveloped, where two strangers meet after a natural disaster. It's written by Montreal actor Stephen Patrick Booth. And the Geordie Theatre Fest returns February, and in April-May, Mike Payette returns to direct From the Stars in the Sky to the Fish in the Sea, based on a children's book by Asian-Canadian writer Kai Cheng Tom about a child that can transform into any person, animal, plant, or thing that it wants. Visit geordie.ca where you can find out more information. I'm Sarah DeAy, and you're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, coming to you from my home yet again this week. It's December 30th, and I'm looking back on some of my favorite interviews from the past year.
COVID-19 is quickly circulating throughout the province of Quebec. It's essential that you get tested only if you have COVID-like symptoms. Symptoms such as fever, cough, and loss of taste or loss of smell. As you may already know, testing still remains one of the best ways to limit outbreaks. For more information, visit quebec.ca/test COVID-19. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Our third and final interview this evening was about a truly remarkable show. Now imagine getting a phone call at 7:30 at night. The ringing is like the flashing of lights before a play. Saying hello, like the curtain rising. The voice on the other line launches into their lines, and you are in a play. As the sole audience member, you can interact as little or as much as you like as the show progresses. That is the idea behind Soon Tomorrow Maybe, by director and writer Marie Ayotte of Théâtre des Chênes. The company's mission is to create accessible, insightful works of art, and here it accomplishes this goal by bringing the play to your phone in the comfort of your home. Soon Tomorrow Maybe was originally written in French as Tantôt Demain Peut-être. It was performed 125 times in 2020 and returned last October in both French and English. The seed came from a conversation with Maria Yot's friend about a subject that remains quite taboo in our culture. This woman confessed that she loved her child but, quote, felt trapped in the day-to-day of motherhood. Ayotte went on to conduct research, doing extensive interviews with over 30 women over the course of 3 years. And the character she crafted is Helen, a mother wrestling with her obligations and regrets. Leigh-Anne Taylor is one of the English-speaking performers from this past fall. She's a very good fit for her role, considering her day job, which is working the phone lines at Info Sociale as a social worker. Here's my conversation with Leigh-Anne. I'm so curious to know how this show works. Soon Tomorrow Maybe, a live phone call play.
Yep. it's such an innovative way to bring theater to the public. I find it so fascinating myself. Basically, an interested audience member purchases a ticket, and then the director lets either myself or my co-actress, Natalie Tanous, because we share the role. She lets either of us know which, performance we've been assigned to for that week, for that day. And all we have is the audience member's first name and their phone number. And we call them from the privacy of our home, and we reach them usually in the privacy of their home. And the play starts immediately. As soon as the person picks up the phone, the play starts immediately.
So When you're at home, are you looking through, I know you have to choose what level of participation do you want to make, the audience does. So do you have a different script for either scenario? And does the other person talk back with you?
There's basically one script that I'm working off of, and I just adapt as I go. You know, it's the same script, but there's room for improv and there's room for some adaptations, because there'll be moments where I may ask the audience member a question, connecting with them as my character, and also assigning a character onto them as well, that the audience member gets to understand fairly quickly once the play has started, that they are also, in a way, playing a role that my character is projecting onto them. And so there'll be little moments here and there where I may just say, oh, I'm so sorry, I didn't even ask how your day was, you know, how are you doing? You know, little different questions here and there throughout the play. And then the audience member can choose based on their comfort level, you know, how much they want to share. Do they want to, you know, like share with me real details about how their day was, what kind of work they do, if they have children or not. Anything, depending on the questions that are part of the script.
Can you tell me about the character you're playing, Helen?
Yes. Helen basically is a mother who is kind of filled with regrets. And she's looking for a chance to redeem herself. She's looking for a chance to explain herself and seek forgiveness from her child, with whom she has not spoken with in a long time. I don't want to give too much away about the play, but yes, that's basically it. And Helen is using this opportunity of a phone conversation to reach out to her child and basically share from the heart about how it was for her to be a mother, and how she struggled in the sense that although she loved her child beyond a doubt, she absolutely loved her child and wanted to have her child, she wanted to be a mother. But as it turned out, the experience of motherhood for Helen was very challenging and very difficult due to a number of circumstances. So she's looking for a chance to kind of share that and explain herself to her child and hopefully seek forgiveness.
This is a really taboo subject, isn't it, Leanne?
It really is. Even for myself as an actress, when I was first reading, you know, the storyline, the synopsis of this play, basically we could say, you know, you could summarize it by say, like, it's about mothers who regret being mothers or mothers who did not enjoy being mothers. It's really almost completely an entirely taboo subject. It's very rare that we will ever hear someone admit to that or share that, confess that. And yet there are women out there who definitely have lived through this experience or perhaps are living through it now, who must feel so alone and isolated and very ashamed because of that, you know, taboo side of this reality for them. But what I find fascinating is the director, Marie Ayotte, who is also the artistic director and writer of the play Soon, Tomorrow, Maybe. She based her play on 3 years of research with women, mothers who have had this experience of not being able to form that maternal bond with their child, as much as they loved their child, as much as they wanted to feel that bond, there were obstacles, and they just struggled, you know, to really feel that bond. So she did her research for the play with interviews from these mothers, as well as professionals who work in the therapeutic field around this subject, therapists, psychologists, etc.
I'm speaking with Lee Ann Taylor, who is performing in Soon Tomorrow Maybe. It is a one-on-one live phone call play that you can catch until about mid-October. Lee Ann, with your background as a professional social worker, that must have really appealed to you, the fact that Marie, the writer and director, is building off these interviews. I think it was sparked by an actual conversation she had with a friend, but she had done the research. Did that speak to you as someone who's in the profession of talking to people and helping people?
Yes, it absolutely did, because I find this type of theater is so intimate, so personal, and very real. And that it's done over the phone, it lends itself to the experience that I already have as a social worker working at Info Social, which is a provincial helpline that's open 24/7. So every single day of the year, at any time of the day, it's a bilingual service. It's anonymous if people prefer. They don't have to identify themselves when they call. People can call for any and all natures of social issues, anywhere from issues of conjugal violence to addictions, to family conflicts, to issues of mental health, depression, anxiety. So absolutely, I find my experience as a social worker really lends itself to having the comfort level required, you know, to do
right.
Telephone theater, in the fact that, yes, we're working off of a script. It feels very natural. It doesn't necessarily feel scripted, but we also have to be comfortable with improv and perhaps unexpected reactions. The play may provoke and trigger some strong emotions depending on the audience member. So yes, I was very drawn to this type of theater and opportunity. I think it's wonderful, especially that, you know, an audience member who may themselves, let's say, have social anxiety and may want to experience theater, but may not be comfortable sitting amongst a crowd, plus with the pandemic that we're still going through to a lesser degree now. But for the longest while, I mean, it was impossible to even go to the theater. So this type of theater makes it accessible for anyone, regardless of their comfort level, regardless of where they live, or whether they may be a caregiver and have difficulty, you know, taking time out of their home with the travel time to get to the theater and back home. So I find this type of theater is completely accessible for anybody who wants to partake, and they can be anonymous at the same time.
Right, because all you have is a phone number and a name. I'm speaking with Lee Ann Taylor, performer in Soon Tomorrow Maybe. It's a one-on-one live phone call play. Without giving away the story or any details about the people that you've already performed for, were there any reactions that surprised you? Or, you know, the writer said that being on the phone allows us to be vulnerable. And I'm wondering if there's any reactions that stood out to you.
I mean, it depends on the audience member that I performed the show for, but what's really surprised me and touched me is, so far, it didn't seem to matter who the audience member was, whether it was a male or a female, whether it was someone who was in their 20s or someone who was older, someone who had children or no children. The play seems to really strike emotional chords with all the audience members. I remember a young woman said, even though she was too young to really start thinking about having a child herself, hearing the play and all the themes that it brought up made her really reflect and appreciate everything her mother went through, you know, in terms of her pregnancy and raising her. And she just said she really missed her mother. And as soon as the play ended, she was calling her mother right away to have a heart-to-heart convo with her. And I was so touched by that. So it seems to make people either reflect about their own childhood, you know, the way they were raised, the relationship they had, or perhaps the relationship that was lacking with their own parent, be it mother or father, thoughts about how they are as a parent, or perhaps the reality that they're not a parent. But it just seems to strike an emotional chord with everyone. And there's a lot of room for shared intimacy through the text, through the audience sharing or sometimes asking questions, offering support to Helen, the character that I play, but also sometimes just through the power of silences, because the play is so intimate and without a distraction of seeing the other person or being, I don't know, worried or insecure, you know, like, how does the person judge me for the way I look, or how do I feel about the way they look? There's none of that type of distraction. All we have is each other's voice and the words and experience being shared, which is profoundly human. And it's really bonding. It's very bonding.
Is this the most unique performance experience that you've ever had?
I think so, because it's just so intimate. And I have to admit that even though I really don't know who the audience members are that I've shared this experience with, I feel so connected to each and every one of them when I'm showing up. You know, we have a small debriefing at the end of the play.
Right.
Just to make sure that the person, you know, perhaps has a chance to ask any leftover questions, or just to process any emotions, or explain a little bit about the background of the process of how the play came to be. But I personally feel quite attached, you know, and I feel like a caring towards each audience member, because it is one-on-one. And I think that's the big difference, is that the connection between myself as an actress and the audience member feels stronger and so much more intimate and direct, because it is just between us two, one-on-one.
That was Leigh-Anne Taylor, an actress who performed this past fall in the one-on-one live phone call play Soon Tomorrow Maybe. For more information about the show, you can visit theatredeschines.com. That's theater and then DECHAINES.com. And a couple days after I spoke with Leigh-Anne, I actually had the pleasure of being her audience for one evening. The experience was remarkable. It was so interesting to be sitting in a chair at home and having someone perform just for me. It was almost nerve-wracking, actually, but it was very intimate. And if you are curious about this experience, I heartily recommend it. You have been listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, a look back at the year that was 2021 in Montreal Theatre. Tonight you heard Ange Loft, the first Indigenous artist in residence at Centaur Theatre, Jimmy Blay, newly appointed artistic director at Geordie Theatre, and Leigh-Anne Taylor, an actress who performed from home in a live telephone play for an audience of one. A very big thank you to my guests. You can hear past episodes of Upstage at ckut.ca under archives. Thank you to Jack Solar, our spoken word coordinator, for making sure this show gets to air. And thank you for tuning in. I'm your host, Sarah DeA. Speak with you next time on Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and ckut.ca. Next time we speak, it will be a new year. Bonne année. Have a wonderful, safe New Year's Eve. Up next is Grey Matters.
You age 65 and over? Now's the time to make your appointment for your booster dose against COVID-19. Visit quebec.ca/COVID-vaccine to book your appointment online. To continue protecting yourself against COVID-19 and its variants, get a booster dose and keep following distancing measures, wearing a mask, and washing your hands. The booster dose, the best way to stay protected longer. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Good evening and welcome to the December 29th edition of Grey Matters. Tonight, to end 2021, play a special lecture by one of our favorite speakers, Noam Chomsky. It's entitled Optimism of the Will. It's recorded in Oro Valley, Arizona in December of this year. Noam Chomsky, of course, is a world famous linguist, author of many books. He's 93, he's still active, and he's the author of books including Propaganda in the Public Mind, How the World Works, Power Systems, Global Discontents, with David Barsamian. So, without further ado, here's tonight's lecture, Optimism of the Will, by Noam Chomsky.
Gramsci, the slogan that he made famous was pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will. We have to look at the world reasonably, without illusions. That's pessimism of the intellect. At the same time, we recognize